Good morning. You're listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information, located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is John, Luke, and Susan, and we will be reading from the Able Tribune and the Lowell Sun, respectively. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Okay, the lead story of the Tribune. Andover, grape expectations. Teaching and testing go hand in hand at community-focused wine shop by Stacy Marcus. Andover, looking to spark a conversation? Bring up the subject of wine. Who doesn't love to banter about a bottle of vino? You don't have to be a sommelier to gab about the grapevine. French chemist and pharmacist Louis Pasteur notes that a bottle of wine contains more philosophy than all the books in the world. Novelist Ernest Hemingway called wine one of the most civilized things in the world. A person with increasing knowledge and sensory education may derive infinite enjoyment from wine, Hemingway wrote in Death of an Afternoon, a quote that could describe a Owenophile Audra Prout, who opened Andover Wine Merchant with her husband, Michael, in October 2024. Although Prout did not grow up in the wine world, her passion for the beverage was uncorked while working at a restaurant to help put herself through college. Her colleagues told her she would make more money if she sold wine. They gave her a glass of white Zinfandel, noting it was the gateway to wine. It was fabulous, Prout remembers. She religiously read Wine Spectator, sampled a variety of vintages, visited California's Napa Valley, and was thirsty to learn more. She started studying wine and going to tastings as often as she could. She also joined a wine tasting group that met weekly. Prout is certified sommelier through the Court of Master Sommeliers. She holds the highest diploma offered from the Wine and Spirit Education Trust in London and teaches at Commonwealth Wine School in Cambridge. I have been teaching in Cambridge and thought I would open a shop, Prout says. Along with wine selling, she envisioned a place where people could take classes, enjoy tasting, and mingle at events. She was excited to invite people to take a journey into the wine world with her. She found a space in Andover on Park Street that used to be a dentist's office, gutted it, and transformed it into a neighborhood wine shop. Andover Wine Merchant is a very busy family business, Prout says, noting that her daughters, Zoe, 16, and Elsa, 13, are heavily involved. Elsa has the title of Chief of Recycling and oversees the breakdown of boxes. Prout is grateful for the warm welcome she has received from the community in the last year and a half. I love doing what I am doing. I love our clients and bringing wine into people's lives, she said. It does not feel like a job. It is a privilege to be able to do something you actually enjoy. She emphasizes that she did not open the shop for transactions. It's more of a relationship business, she says. Prout invites people to dive in as much or as little as they feel comfortable. I love what I'm doing. I love our clients and bringing wine to people's lives. It's my job to listen and give them what they need, she says. The shop is about the people of Andover. I am the facilitator. For those seeking to learn more about wine, Prout suggests starting with our monthly introductory workshops, which are hands-on, interactive tastings designed to build confidence. The shop also hosts classes on different types of wine, with upcoming sessions including Pinot Noir and Cabernet, as well as a special Rosé All Day event on the first Saturday in May. Additionally, free wine tastings are held every Friday evening, with four new wines featured each week. Prout enjoys helping people unearth and describe their wine preferences. She acknowledges that there are a lot of words used in talking about wine that may be confusing, and she was always happy to help people understand the vernacular, whether they are at a restaurant or in a wine shop. Andover Wine Merchant selection covers a wide range of price points and also includes local craft beers and cider. You can find a bottle under $20 or over $300. The sweet spot for many customers is between 25 and 55, Prout says. She recalls a recent customer who came into the shop asking about wine to bring to a friend's dinner party. He texted Prout at 10 p.m. to let her know that the wine she recommended was perfect for the gathering, calling it outstanding. When clients expressed that the wine they selected was great, Prout wants to know about the vintage that made them smile. That's while she was doing this, she said. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, John Luke. In the Sun, downtown Lowell, Heritage Properties seals deal on $76 million housing project. 2027 groundbreaking expected on site of old district courthouse. In Lowell, Heritage Properties has announced plans to build a six-story mixed-use building of approximately 200 units on the footprint of the old district courthouse on Heard Street in downtown Lowell. The locally owned and operated real estate investment, development, and management firm was selected through a 2025 request for a proposal to bring mixed-use residential development into the downtown at the formerly state-owned property. Development of the parcel also meets the goals in the city's Lowell Forward Master Plan. The deal represents a major milestone by the Golden Administration and the City Council to revitalize underutilized properties in the city through strategic development. The selection of Heritage Properties as the developer of the former District Courthouse site reflects Lowell's commitment to expanding housing opportunities in the city. City Manager Tom Golden said, "We look forward to working closely with Heritage Properties to ensure this redevelopment strengthens the neighborhood, supports our local economy, and continues Lowell's momentum as a vibrant and welcoming city of opportunity." The district court opened in 1925, but has been vacant since 2020, when the new Lowell Justice Center, rechristened the Cornelius F. Kernan Judicial Center, opened on Jackson Street. The almost 60,000 square foot property is located at the intersection of Heard, George, and William Streets in Lowell's historic district. The neighborhood features a blend of commercial and institutional spaces and is situated directly across the city-owned Lower Locks Municipal Parking Garage. Heritage Properties President Jeff Bush said in a statement that the company will work closely with the city on a thoughtful redevelopment plan that will provide residential and commercial space. "We are excited to work with the city in delivering a redevelopment that honors 41 Heard Street's history while providing new, high-quality housing for downtown Lowell," Bush said. "In line with the city's goals, this project represents an opportunity to create much-needed housing, strengthen the downtown neighborhood, and ensure this historic site continues to serve the Lowell community for years to come." The City Council met in executive session April 14 to discuss the disposition of the property. Unlike meetings that are open to the public, executive sessions are closed discussions that provide members the opportunity to meet privately over matters that may have a detrimental effect on the negotiating position of the city. The deal represents 2 years of dogged work by the city's Department of Planning and Development, which shepherded the property through a complicated acquisition process. On the last day of the 193rd session of the Massachusetts Legislature in 2024, Lowell's legislative delegation secured passage of a home rule petition allowing the city to acquire the vacant Heard and Gorm Street courthouses. The act authorized the commissioner of the State Division of Capital Asset Management and Maintenance to convey the parcels of land to the city. Under the terms of the legislation, the city had the opportunity to purchase the properties for a nominal cost of $1 each, which it only exercised on the district courthouse parcel. Last month, the Superior Courthouse sold for $1.925 million to a private developer during a public auction organized by DCAMM, held at the Gorm Street location. Although the purchase price by Heritage Properties for the Heard Street parcel was not disclosed, the RFP notes that the $390,000 application fee paid by the designated developer is non-refundable upon execution of the land disposition agreement. The city is not obligated to select the proposal that offers the highest purchase price, the RFP said. The successful proposal will be the one that is most advantageous to the city and best meets the selection criteria. According to the city's RFP, the appraised value of the parcel is $3.9 million. Later this summer, Heritage Properties will present its site plans for the Heard Street property to the various land use boards, including the Historic Commission and the Planning and Zoning Boards. The nearly $76 million project is estimated to break ground in 2027, with a floor-plan mix of studio and one- and two-bedroom units. In addition to the Heard Street development, the developer is finishing construction on the Emery, a $10 million project that features 37 market-rate apartments across five floors, 23 studios, 10 one-bedrooms, and 4 two-bedrooms. Last month, the company announced pre-leasing on the project located at Middlesex and Pearl Streets with a late fall move-in date. Back to you, Jean-Luc.
Thank you, Susan. Didn't realize there was a follow-up mini-article after the next one on Andover Wine Merchant. Their address is 63 Park Street, Suite 6, Andover. And the hours are Tuesdays through Saturdays from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. And they have free wine tastings every Friday night from 5 to 7. For more information, you can call 978-300-8001 or go to their website, andoverwinemerchant.com. Okay, Haverhill. Spill prompts call for EPA funding. Aging infrastructure needs immediate attention. Federal follow-through. Boston. Members of the state's congressional delegation are calling on the Trump administration to provide more federal funding for communities to upgrade water and sewer infrastructure in response to the sewage spill in Haverhill that fouled beaches along the Merrimack River for days. In a letter to Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin, Reps Lori Tehan, Democrat of Westford, and Seth Moulton, Democrat of Salem, said the June 26th sewer main break that allowed millions of gallons of sewage to spill into the river during the July 4 weekend is a clear example of the immediate impacts of the state's aging water and sewer systems. Specifically, the lawmakers said, the incident highlighted the need for the federal government to help cover the cost of upgrading so-called combined sewer overflows. As communities across the Commonwealth continue recovering from the recent spill, sewer main failure in Haverhill, it is increasingly clear that local governments, even those acting responsibly and proactively, cannot shoulder the cost of long-term infrastructure modernization without stronger, more reliable federal partnership, they wrote. Haverhill, for example, has been working closely with the EPA for years under a 2016 consent decree that requires substantial upgrades to its sewer system and treatment plant, they said, but said the federal government hasn't provided the money needed for the upgrades. The city has acted in good faith, investing heavily in planning, engineering, and permitting to overhaul a decades-old system and reduce the risk of pollution and public health crises, they wrote. However, Despite the city's longstanding efforts to modernize its aging wastewater infrastructure, the lack of sustained federal investment has left the infrastructure still vulnerable to incidents like this. On Tuesday, the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure adopted an amendment by Moulton boosting funding for Haverhill and a reauthorization of the Federal Water Resources Development Act from $40 million to $50 million. But Moulton said the additional funding is still a drop in the pan compared to the overall cost of upgrading the city's water and sewer infrastructure. This CESO has been devastating to communities, clamors, and shoreside industries downstream from Haverhill, he said. Haverhill's sewer system is one of the oldest in the country, and a temporary bypass is not an acceptable solution. These CSOs are polluting our environment and compromising public health. We need to work across all levels of government to find a permanent solution. Every year, hundreds of millions of gallons of untreated and partially treated sewage pour into the 117-mile Merrimack River from 229 active CSOs, according to the State Department of Environmental Protection. Sewage treatment plants in New Hampshire also contribute to the problem. 10 days after the leak, it spilled an estimated 40 million gallons of rough sewage into the river. The Merrimack River Watershed Council said MRWC testing showed that bacteria levels back in the normal expected range downstream in the break, and state testing cleared the way for all Plum Island and Salisbury beaches to open. Designed long before the Clean Water Act was written into law in the early 1970s, the treatment system collects stormwater in the same pipes as sewage and designed to overflow when they become inundated, usually because of heavy rain. CSOs are still in place in nearly 160 municipalities nationwide, most of them in the northeast, according to the EPA. Public health officials say large and frequent overflows pose health risks to those who use the river for boating and swimming, as well as communities that draw drinking water from it. Estimated 600,000 people get drinking water from the Merrimack River, Lowell included. Raw sewage also causes algae blooms, which can be toxic to people and deprive water bodies of oxygen, killing fish and other marine life. Sewage treatment plant operators have been making upgrades to reduce CSO discharges, as the price for dealing with the problem is beyond most budgets. In their letter to the EPA, Trahan and Moulton pointed out that the Trump administration's fiscal 2027 budget proposal would cut federal water infrastructure funding by roughly 90%, slashing the Clean Water State Revolving Fund from about $2.5 billion to just $155 million. Underfunding these programs forces communities to defer essential repairs, leaving systems vulnerable to catastrophic public health failures like the one Haverhill just experienced, they wrote. We urge you to work with our offices to identify long-term federal funding streams to encourage cities like Haverhill to not continually overburdened by the growing cost to replace aging water infrastructure. Susan.
In the Sun, roadwork redesigned for E. Merrimack at High Street intersection. Safety concerns at vehicle-centric roadway will be addressed. In Lowell, the intersection of East Merrimack and High Streets is scheduled for road and sidewalk reconstruction during the summer roadwork season through the city's American with Disabilities Act sidewalk improvement contract. The work is in response to a motion by City Councilor Belinda Duran, who asked the administration of City Manager Tom Golden to look into what might be possible. Last Wednesday night, there was a car accident on East Merrimack Street across from the Immaculate Conception School, with the vehicle going through a fence and landing in the front yard of a house, she said during the April 14 meeting. I can understand why the neighbors are upset, especially since a number of parked cars have been hit on that block over the last several years. The two streets at the high traffic intersection do not meet at a 90-degree angle, which creates a sight distance constraint for vehicles approaching the intersection on northbound High Street, turning left onto East Merrimack Street, or continuing straight across East Merrimack on High Street. Both Lowell Regional Transit Authority and Merrimack Valley Transit buses turn at this intersection, requiring wide radii to be maintained to accommodate the turns. The corner is home to the Immaculate Conception School, the All People Church, formerly the Christ Church United, homes and a three-story business with little street setback. Crosswalk markings are faded, and the two-lane road features curbside parking on both sides of the street. The neighbors apparently have asked for a stop sign for a number of years at East Merrimack and High Street to discourage speeding as cars come up East Merrimack from downtown toward Nesmith Street, Duran said. The city's engineering and traffic departments said the intersection had a vehicle-centric design and said the work will include road and pedestrian improvements for visibility and safety. The sidewalk modifications include curb extensions to reduce the pedestrian crossing lengths on the two intersection approaches where students at the Immaculate Conception School cross the intersection. The curb extensions and proposed striped island area will increase sight distances for turning vehicles by eliminating vehicles parking at the corner and will reinforce the stop condition on High Street. The undated memo said that was presented at the council's Tuesday night meeting. The existing crosswalk on the east side of the intersection will be relocated to Ash Street, and the bus stop at that location will be striped. The relocation of the crosswalk will remove the potential for student and other pedestrian crossing conflicts, with vehicles turning from High Street onto East Merrimack Street East toward Nesmith Street, as well as improve visibility of crossing pedestrians, the memo said, which will define the area as a shared space. Back to you, Jean-Luc.
Thank you, Susan. Board denies parole in 1997 taxi driver murder. Methuen. A parole board has cited ongoing mental health challenges as reasoning for denying parole to a man convicted of second-degree murder and the 1997 killing of a taxi driver. Ricardo Reyes was 20 when he and Israel Perez, 19, entered a local cab with the intent to rob the driver, the Massachusetts Parole Board said in their decision reached last week. The driver was held at gunpoint before Perez fatally shot Juan Vasquez, 30, in the back of the head, according to testimony from the two men. Reyes later said the shooting was an accident. The case went unsolved for more than 2 years before law enforcement homed in on Reyes and Perez. After the murder, the two men were picked up by friends. They later sold the murder weapon, a .22 caliber gun, after going to a bar. Reyes was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after pleading guilty to second-degree murder on June 21, 2002. He also pleaded guilty to armed robbery and received a 10 to 12-year sentence that was said to run concurrently to his other term. He was previously denied parole in 2022 and 2025. He will not be eligible for another review for 2 years after the most recent January 27 hearing. The board said Reyes had failed to show rehabilitation in the decision to deny him parole last year. The decision cited disciplinary reports and a lack of participation in prison programming. The year's decision discussed his mental health. Mr. Reyes has a history of noncompliance with mental health treatment, which has been followed by rapid decompensation and need for hospitalization, Board Chair Angelo Gomez said in the decision. The board received testimony in support of Reyes' release from his daughter and testimony opposing his release from Assistant District Attorney Emily Mello. In addition The majority of the board remains concerned that his release plan is uncertain, and the board needs more confirmation that his medication and mental health needs will be met, Gomez said in the decision. The board concludes that Ricardo Reyes has not demonstrated a level of rehabilitation that would make his release compatible with the welfare of society. The board was not unanimous in his decision, though, with two members voting to grant Reyes parole, but into a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement detainer, according to the decision. The board also had concerns about Ray's ability to access medical care in the event he's released into the Dominican Republic. The decision made no mentions of Ray's legal status in the country beyond referencing the request from ICE. Reyes was represented by attorney Shannon Lopez during the recent parole hearing. Perez was granted conditional parole with a series of strict conditions in 2023. He was 45 at the time. Susan.
In the Sun, Billerica. Disagreement arises over fire chief search. Town union officials urge manager to keep search internal. In Billerica, back in January, Fire Chief Robert Cole provided the town with a one-year notice that he will retire from the role, and now local officials and the town's fire union are urging the town manager to keep the search for Cole's successor within the department. While Cole's retirement is still months away, disagreement has recently arisen over town manager Chris Dillon's move to open the search process up to external candidates. In a statement to The Sun Monday afternoon, Dillon said that as town manager, he has a responsibility to the community to hire the best and most qualified candidate for vacant positions. These decisions should not be made based on political pressure, but on who can lead our department by improving efficiencies, staying current with best practices, and motivating staff, said Dillon. I am following the same hiring process through civil service that was completed 10 years ago when the town hired Chief Cole. In a statement Thursday on social media, the Billerica Firefighters, IAFF Local 1495, President Gary DeSilva said the department doesn't need to look across the state or the country to find its next leader. We already have several outstanding candidates who have spent their careers serving this town. They've worked their way through the ranks, led firefighters on difficult calls, earned the respect of the department, and proven they can handle the job. I said the union statement. What makes them even more qualified is that they know Billerica inside and out. Many grew up here, raised their families here, and have spent decades protecting this community. They know our neighborhoods, schools, businesses, roadways, and the people who live here. They understand this town because it's their town. That's something you can't teach in a few months. DeSilva urged Dillon to reconsider this decision and give our own firefighters the opportunity they've worked so hard to earn. I truly believe Billerica will be best served by a chief who already knows this department, knows this community, and has spent a career protecting both, said DeSilva. The Professional Firefighters of Massachusetts, the statewide union for Massachusetts firefighters, said in a statement that same day that the chief's role should go to qualified and worthy candidates within the Billerica Fire Department. As a result, we implore PFFM members from outside departments to refrain from applying for the fire chief position in the town of Billerica. PFFM President Richard McKinnon said in the statement, that sentiment was echoed by a number of local officials, including most of the Billerica Select Board. Chair Mike Riley said in a statement Friday he had met with union officials and Dillon to discuss the matter. I have watched this group of firefighters raise their level of professionalism and heroism and have no doubt the most qualified applicants are within our department. I will continue to advocate for hiring from within our ranks in all town-held positions and building that foundation from the bottom up, which is exactly what Billerica Fire has done, said Riley. I have faith that our leaders will rise to the top of any outside list, but appreciate the confidence in showing them they deserve, and we the public deserve the best, and that's right inside our department. Board member Dinah Favreau said in her own statement Friday that she had drafted a policy proposal to make internal promotions the standard for the fire chief role, with a provision to expand the search externally if there are no qualified internal candidates. Our firefighters have dedicated their careers to serving the residents of Billerica. They have invested years developing their leadership skills, gaining operational experience, and building an understanding of the unique needs of our community, said Favreau. When we have qualified individuals who have demonstrated the knowledge, experience, and commitment to lead, they deserve the first opportunity to do so. Promoting from within not only recognizes that dedication, but also provides continuity, preserves institutional knowledge, and reinforces a culture where hard work and professional development are rewarded. Board member Mike Rosa said in a statement he was very disappointed to learn that the town manager went to civil service and requested applicants outside of Billerica to fill the fire chief's position. I had strongly advocated for staying internal because we have a lot of very qualified candidates. The reason we have such qualified candidates is no accident, said Rosa. Chief Cole and former town manager John Curran restructured the fire department so we would have cross-training with the officers to better prepare for them to move through the ranks. I feel very strongly that we want the best qualified candidate, but we should always look for an internal candidate first. Rosa proposed a similar policy to Vervose to prioritize internal search when vacancies open up for the police or fire chief positions in town. An internal search was also supported by board member Daniel Darris O'Connor. I believe in a simple principle. If you work hard and prove yourself over the course of a career, you deserve a fair shot to advance within your career, Darris O'Connor said in a statement. That's not just fair. It's how you build trust and loyalty within a department, and it's how you keep good people invested in their future here instead of looking elsewhere. State Rep. Mark Lombardo said Billerica firefighters possess something that no outside candidate can replicate, a deep understanding of our department, its personnel, and the town of Billerica. Many have devoted their entire careers to serving this community and have earned the respect and trust of their fellow firefighters and residents alike. For many members of the department, becoming fire chief represents the culmination of a lifetime of service and professional development, said Lombardo. Opening the position to outside candidates would not only diminish those aspirations, but could also have a significant negative impact on morale throughout the department. Our firefighters should know that hard work, dedication, and years of service create a genuine opportunity to advance into the department's highest leadership position. In a phone call with the Sun Tuesday morning, Cole declined to give his thoughts on the matter, but said that he had spoken with Dylan and gave him advice, but that it is his decision. Cole said he gave a full year of notice for his departure to comply with personnel bylaws, and that he chose to do so now because he had maxed out his retirement benefits. His plan after retirement is to travel, but Cole did not rule out taking another job in the future. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. Merrimack Valley, Wildfires Create Colorful Smoky Skies by Jill Hamasinski. If it's not the heat, it's the humidity, and now it's the smoke. Forecasters are tracking giant plumes of smoke that blanketed the heat throughout the Merrimack Valley in southern New Hampshire. Husband and wife forecasters Matt and Danielle Noyes said those who saw a milky silvery or orange tint to the sky weren't being deceived. We are currently tracking a massive plume of high-altitude wildfire smoke that has traveled hundreds of miles to settle directly over the northeast, said the Noyes, who operate the New England Weather Network 1 degree outside from North Andover. They explained the atmospheric haze is a result of explosive wildfire growth in northern Minnesota and western Ontario, Canada. Driven by a favorable diving jet stream, a thick corridor of smoke is advecting, moving horizontally, straight into our New England backyard, according to 1 degree outside. A heat advisory remains in effect until 8 p.m. Wednesday, according to the National Weather Service, Boston. The Weather Service also acknowledged the brown tint in the sky and said wildfire smoke aloft from Canada has shifted over the region. While temperatures reached the 90s, meteorologists also warned of high humidity and heat-related illnesses. Locals were advised to drink plenty of fluids, stay in air conditioning, out of the sun, and check in on relatives and neighbors. 1 degree outside explained tiny smoke particles act as a natural filter for sunlight. They scatter and block shorter, cooler wavelengths of light, like blues and violets, while amplifying and allowing longer, warmer wavelengths, like deep reds, bright pinks, and oranges, to pass straight through. A spectacular trade-off for the smoky skies could be fiery sunsets over the next few nights. The Noyes want your pics and a community gallery they are compiling at reports@onedegreeoutside.com. Susan.
In the sun, in the sky, wildfire smoke colors skies. The haze over Massachusetts drifted in from Canada, more expected today. From the Boston Herald. Wildfire smoke blew down from Canada over Boston on Tuesday, turning skies yellow and brown as it blocked the sun and tempered the rising heat through the day. And there's more on the way Wednesday. We are seeing pretty extensive wildfire smoke pretty high up today, coming from wildfires burning in Canada out towards western Ontario. National Weather Service meteorologist Candace Harrodsanson said Tuesday, "It's just basically coming through with how the flow is impacting the region." National Weather Service forecasters canceled the heat advisory for the Boston area and much of the region through Wednesday, keeping it in place for parts of southeastern Massachusetts, northern Connecticut, and most of Rhode Island, as the smoke coverage limited temperatures. The high temperature reached 90 degrees in Boston on Tuesday, Harrodsanson said, down from heat indices that forecasts originally said could reach over 100 degrees. And any breaks between, like some thinning smoke, temperatures have been able to climb up a little bit more, said Harrodsanson. But they haven't been able to get really to the magnitude we were expecting. Over 800 wildfires were burning in Canada on Tuesday, according to the Canadian Wildfire Information System, with 97 listed out of control and a large grouping around southwestern Ontario leading down to the Minnesota border. NWS maps of the air movement show the wildfire smoke reaching all the way down to New York City. Despite the smoke, the U.S. Air Quality Index rated air quality around Boston moderate on Tuesday, with sensors reporting stable conditions as of the late afternoon around downtown. The index recommended unusually sensitive people consider reducing outdoor activity and go inside to cleaner air if you have symptoms. However, the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services declared a smoke advisory in the state through Wednesday evening, warning the smoke pollution is expected to reach levels that could cause a hazy appearance in the sky, odors, and respiratory health effects for unusually sensitive individuals. NHDES officials advise anyone who is unusually sensitive to air pollution to take precautions and protect their health by limiting prolonged or heavy exertion, especially outdoors, the department said, noting symptoms include chest pain, palpitations, shortness of breath, and difficulty breathing, and may affect those with asthma and other existing lung diseases. Even healthy individuals may experience mild health effects and should consider limiting strenuous or prolonged activities. Conditions are expected to improve Thursday, the department said, but there is potential for some high particle pollution to persist for the rest of the week. Another plume of wildfire smoke is likely to shift southward into the region in larger concentrations Wednesday, NWS stated. The current is likely to again limit temperatures and bring hazy skies and a hint of smoky smell in the air. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. Today in history from the Associated Press. Today is Wednesday, July 15, the 196th day of 2026. There are 169 days left in the year. Today in history, on July 15, 1799, the Rosetta Stone, a key to deciphering ancient Egyptian scripts, was found at Fort Julian in the Nile Delta during the Napoleonic campaign in Egypt. In 1834, the Spanish Inquisition was abolished more than 350 years after its creation. In 1870, Georgia became the last Confederate state to be readmitted to the Union. In 1913, Democrat Augustus Bacon of Georgia became the first person elected to the U.S. Senate under the terms of the recently ratified 17th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, providing for popular election of senators. In 1916, the Boeing Company, originally known as Pacific Aero Products Company, was founded in Seattle. 1975, three American astronauts blasted off aboard an Apollo spacecraft after two Soviet cosmonauts were launched aboard a Soyuz spacecraft for a mission that included a link-up of the two ships in orbit. 1976, a 36-hour kidnap ordeal began for 26 school children and their bus driver as they were abducted near Chowchilla, California, by three gunmen and imprisoned in an underground cell. The captors escaped unharmed. The kidnappers were caught. 1996, MSNBC, a 24-hour all-news network, made its debut on cable and the Internet. 1997, fashion designer Gianni Versace, 50, was shot dead outside his Miami Beach home. Suspected gunman Andrew Philip Cunanan, 27, was found dead 8 days later, suicide. In 2002, John Walker Lind, an American who fought alongside the Taliban in Afghanistan, pleaded guilty in federal court in Alexandria, Virginia, to two felonies in a deal sparing him life in prison. Walker was released in 2019 after serving 17 years of a 20-year sentence. 2006, Twitter, now known as X, was launched to the public. 2019, avowed white supremacist James Alex Fields Jr. was sentenced by a state court to life in prison plus 419 years for killing one person and injuring dozens when he deliberately drove his car into a crowd of anti-racism protesters during a rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. The previous month, Fields received a life sentence on 29 federal hate crime charges. 2020, George Floyd's family filed a lawsuit against the city of Minneapolis and the four police officers charged in his death, charging the officers violated Floyd's rights when they restrained him, and the city allowed a culture of excessive force, racism, and impunity to flourish in its police force. The city would agree to pay $27 million to settle the lawsuit March 2021. Susan.
In the Sun World's Cup, main volunteer named Unsung Hero. England star Jude Bellingham recognizes anti-doping chaperone. from the Boston Herald. England's Jude Bellingham has been among the World Cup's brightest stars, but a volunteer at Boston Stadium has caught his eye, triggering special recognition as one of the tournament's few unsung heroes. Amid his nation's run to Wednesday's semifinal against Argentina, Bellingham met Gary Newell of Cape Elizabeth, Maine, in the high-stakes, strictly controlled anti-doping room after a group stage scoreless draw with Ghana. The brief interaction led to a special message of thanks from Bellingham for the spark Newell brought to the tournament as a volunteer. "I have heard you have given your whole life to football," Bellingham said in a video message to Newell, "and I just wanted to say thank you for everything you have done for those kids you've helped and given them the opportunity to get to the stage like me." Bellingham, the tournament's top-scoring midfielder with 6 goals and 1 assist in 6 matches, has dominated in England's World Cup run, including consecutive braces in the knockout stages against Mexico and Norway. Newell, a longtime volunteer soccer coach in his small Maine community, helped in FIFA's anti-doping program throughout the 7 matches at Boston Stadium. There, he linked with Bellingham as a chaperone accompanying the star player following a sample collection. A recipient of a rare unsung hero award from FIFA, Newell said the recognition from Bellingham overwhelmed him with emotion. "Immense," Newell said in a video after he received the award. "Not only is Jude one of the best players in the world, but he is also one of the best human beings. I am thankful that I got to witness that firsthand, seeing him as a professional on the pitch as well as off of it." Newell's message to Bellingham is simple: go England. For Newell, this wasn't just a tournament gig, it was the culmination of a life dedicated to soccer. He founded his own community club in Maine, naming it Three Lions Soccer, after the national team he's cheered for his entire life. Even among the ranks of 50,000 World Cup volunteers, Newell stood out, not just for his efficiency in the anti-doping unit, but for the morale he boosted by famously surprising fellow volunteers with Maine lobster rolls before every shift. Newell's volunteer service turned into a special reunion with a former player he coached in high school, Kevin Clark, who worked as a FIFA venue operations director at Boston Stadium. "He pushes you to the limit every time," Clark said in a video. Newell described volunteering as very difficult to put into words. "If you can gather up a gamut of emotions, whether it's grace, seeing people volunteer and being selfless, and being a part of something, the happiness, the joy that we have volunteering, there is not just one simple thing I could say about the experience." Back to you, Jean-Luc.
Thank you, Susan. Judge denies Manning Martin appeal for ballot access. Ann Manning Martin, a Republican hopeful for lieutenant governor, cannot appear on the September 1 primary ballot under a new Supreme Judicial Court ruling. On Tuesday, Justice Frank Gaziano denied Manning Martin's appeal of an Essex County Superior Court ruling that sustained the state's ballot law commission's decision to strike her name from the September's primary ballot. Republican candidate for Lieutenant Governor Sean Oliver and Democratic Party Executive Director Adam Roof filed similar complaints with the commission, alleging Manning Martin of Peabody had filed fraudulent nomination signatures and didn't get the necessary 10,000 certified signatures to appear on the ballot. The complaints were considered as one, and on June 26, the commission sustained their challenges to 1,279 of the 10,692 signatures Manning Martin submitted. Manning Martin then appealed the decision to Essex County Superior Court. On July 10, Essex County Superior Court Judge Jeffrey Karp addressed Roof and Oliver's motion separately. Karp overruled the commission's decision on Roof's complaint and upheld the commission ruling on Oliver's objection. Karp ruled that the commission's decision to bar Manning Martin's name from appearing on September's primary ballot was affirmed. Karp said the decision to overturn the commission's ruling on Roof's complaint stemmed from his failure to comply with a requirement to send the objection via certified mail. Karp found that Oliver complied with the mailing requirement and said that there was substantial, if not overwhelming, evidence showing that the 1,279 signatures the commission invalidated were not signed by voters as required by law. Manning Martin appealed Karp's decision and contended that the commission's decision should be overturned for several reasons, including that violated her constitutional right to a ballot access, made legal errors, ignored evidence, and did not have jurisdiction over the issue, and misinterpreted the facts and the law. Manning Martin argued the commission did not have the jurisdiction to rule on Oliver's objection because it was not mailed in time, and he did not provide her with enough information on the signatures being challenged. In an 8-page decision, Gaziano disagreed. Gaziano noted there was substantial evidence in the record showing that Oliver had sent the objection in time. Also, he said, it is undisputed that Oliver provided Manning Martin with a list containing the page number and line of each signature in question. Also, like Karp, Gaziano concluded that there is substantial, if not overwhelming, evidence that the signatures the commission invalidated were not signed by the voters. In short, there was substantial evidence to support the SBLC's decision to strike 1,279 signatures within Manning Martin's nomination papers, and the petition has not demonstrated that she is entitled to relief, Gaziano said in a decision. As part of her appeal, Manning Martin filed a motion asking the Supreme Judicial Court to order Secretary of State William Galvin's office to get a waiver from the federal deadline to issue ballots so the candidate can exhaust her appeal to get her name on the ballot. Court records show Galvin's office must have a final list of candidates by Tuesday to meet the July 18 federal deadline to issue primary ballots. Gaziano also denied that motion. Susan.
In the Sun, state police, a brawling trooper suspended with pay. Quincy request for formal charge is still pending. From the Boston Herald. The state police trooper seen on video pummeling a fellow officer in a bar in Quincy late last month is suspended with pay, awaiting possible charges, the Herald has learned. The officer in the one-sided fight was taken off the job on July 2, 6 days after the clash at the Real House Brew Pub in Marina Bay. He earned more than $200,000 last year, according to state comptroller records. However, a request for formal charges is still pending, and the state police have yet to publicly identify the two officers seen fighting on the video. Sources have confirmed the identities of the two police officers to the Herald. Since the fight was first reported by the Herald, Quincy police have applied for a criminal complaint in the case. This came after the fight on June 26 inside the Quincy pub went viral. One officer was clearly the aggressor, as the other trooper was punched in the head and ducked a few other swings while he sat at the bar with an unidentified woman on the stool next to him, as the video shows. The Herald has learned that both MSP troopers were also reassigned to the Division of Field Services on June 30. They had both been working in the Suffolk DA's office in the elite SPDU unit, but were taking off that duty. The State Police Detective Unit is an investigative arm of the MSP, where the officers probe cases ranging from murder to drug trafficking under the control of the district attorney's office to which they are assigned. The Division of Field Services is responsible for the state's roadways. The next step is up to the courts after local police sent the case to them. The Quincy Police Department applied for a criminal complaint in Quincy District Court in connection with an incident that occurred on June 26, 2026, in Marina Bay. A Quincy police sergeant wrote in a statement last week, We have no further information to share at this time. Back to you, John Luke.
And now it is time for a mid-show break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. So back to the Eagle Tribune, fun stuff here. Splash Bash next week in Dover. The Merrimack Valley YMCA is hosting a pool party, Splash Bash, from 1 to 3 p.m. on Saturday, July 25 at 165 Haverhill Street. Bring the whole family to enjoy the slip-and-slides, sprinklers, water-themed games, and the Weebit, a floating inflatable playground. The event is free and open to everyone. Registration is required and space is limited. Folks are asked to register all individuals attending. Go to facebook.com/MVYMCA to reserve a spot. Registration closes on July 17. Shoreline Cleanup Day, Haverhill. The Conservation Department and Crescent Yacht Club present Haverhill Shoreline Cleanup Day, scheduled from 9 to 11 a.m. on Sunday, July 26 at 30 Ferry Street. Join community volunteers for a morning of environmental stewardship along the Merrimack River. Volunteers will work both by boat and along the shoreline to remove litter and debris between the Crescent Yacht Club and Marianas Marina, helping to protect wildlife and improving water quality. After the cleanup, there will be a cookout at the Yacht Club. Contact Crescent Yacht Club at 978-374-9683 for more information. Nonsense, coming to Haverhill. Black Dog Theater's next show, Nonsense, the musical, will have three performances next month at Haverhill City Hall, 4 Summer Street. The show times are set for 7:30 p.m. on July 24, 7:30 p.m. on July 25, and 2 p.m. on July 26. Nonsense is a musical comedy where the Little Sisters of Hoboken turn an emergency fundraiser into an evening of songs, dancing, audience interaction, and chaos. Five nuns take the stage, and nothing goes quite as planned. The production will be directed by Todd Coolidge, with musical directed by John Eldridge, and stage managed by Alex Thoreau, choreographed by Dust Tenner and Haley Unger. The cast consists of Sue Brother, Carolyn Schneier, Karen Mullen, Olivia Mincello, and Tessa Tropiano. As part of the group's community mission, Black Dog Theater is collecting food and supplies for the MSPCA. Bring an item from their wish list or show proof of a purchase or donation and receive one free raffle basket ticket. Tickets are $25 for general admission and $20 for seniors and kids. They will be available for purchase at the door or through the website at blackdogtheater.org. Methuen Police 2026 Golf Tournament. The Methuen Police 2026 Golf Tournament Foundation Charity Golf Tournament is set to start on 8 a.m. on Monday, August 31 at Hickory Hills Golf Course, 200 North Lowell Street. For a $700 tournament cost per person, golfers are welcome to 18 holes, a cart, lunch, a swag bag, and an invite to an awards dinner following the round. Check-in is scheduled for 8:30 a.m. with a shotgun start at 9 a.m. There are sponsorship opportunities for this event ranging from $1,000 to $5,000. Team registrations, sponsorships, and donations can be made at birdease.com/MPCF golf. And the first part is birdease, B-I-R-D-E-A-S-E, facebook.com/mpcefgolf. Susan.
In the Sun, Voices of Revolution. Groton celebrates America's 250th historic reenactment, Revolutionary War speakers, and reception July 19. Groton. Destination Groton invites residents and visitors to attend Voices of Revolution, Groton's Legacy at Bunker Hill and Beyond on Sunday, July 19, a special Massachusetts 250 event celebrating Groton's pivotal role in the American Revolution. The free public event begins at 12 p.m. on the Groton Town Common with a Revolutionary War reenactment featuring the 6th Middlesex Regiment and the Concord Fife and Drum Corps. At 1 p.m., attendees will proceed to the Richardson Mies Performing Arts Center at Lawrence Academy for an afternoon of presentations by leading historians and authors, followed by a reception with light refreshments. The event is funded in part through a generous grant from the Massachusetts Office of Travel and Tourism's MA-250 grant program. On April 19, 1775, 185 Groton men gathered on the common in front of the old meeting house to answer the call and march toward Concord, said local historian and event moderator Joshua Vollmer. Many would continue on toward Cambridge, where Groton's Colonel William Prescott would later command American forces at the Battle of Bunker Hill. This event offers an opportunity to better understand Groton's role in the founding of our nation. Featured speakers include welcome from Groton Select Board Chair Peter Cunningham, Amelia McNutt, historian and author of America's First Soldiers, presenting on the Massachusetts men who fought for independence during the opening years of the Revolution. Paul Statey, acclaimed author, art historian, and professor emeritus of fine arts at Mount Holyoke College, presenting Picturing the American Revolution, an exploration of how artists captured and shaped the story of America's founding. Julie Hall, president of the Charleston Historical Society, discussing the story of the Asa Pollard musket and its connection to Groton. Pollard was the first patriot killed at the Battle of Bunker Hill and stood alongside Colonel William Prescott during the battle. We are honored to welcome such distinguished speakers to Groton as we continue to commemorate America's 250th anniversary, said Destination Groton Chair Greg Sheldon. Their presentations will help bring revolutionary history to life while highlighting Groton's significant contributions to the American Revolution. Admission is free, but advanced registration is encouraged. To learn more and reserve a seat, visit destinationgroton.com/RSVP. Back to you, John Luke.
Okay. Important stuff for traveling around here. Overnight I-495 closures planned for bridge replacement. Haverhill. Drivers using Interstate 495 in Haverhill should expect overnight detours this week due to a $337 million reconstruction project. Last week, the Massachusetts Department of Transportation announced overnight closures of the I-495 southbound exit 106 on-ramp to Industrial Avenue and the Industrial Avenue on-ramp to I-495 southbound as foundation construction begins for the Industrial Avenue bridges. Exit 106 southbound off-ramp will be closed as needed between 9 p.m. and 5 a.m. and the following morning until Friday, July 17. The Industrial Ave on-ramp to I-495 southbound will also be closed as needed between the same dates and hours. In addition, overnight lane closures will be in place as needed on the I-495 northbound and southbound bridges between exits 105 and 106 from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. until Saturday, July 18th. Drivers looking to access exit 106 on I-490 southbound will be detoured to exit 104 at Route 110 Merrimack Street. 110/Merrimack Street. Motorists should turn left at the top of the exit ramp and follow posted signs to the I-495 northbound on-ramp before continuing north to the exit 106 Industrial Avenue off-ramp. Motorists traveling from Industrial Avenue to I-495 southbound will instead be redirected to the northbound on-ramp and continue to exit 107 at River Street. They should turn left at the top of the ramp and follow signs to the I-495 southbound on-ramp. MassDOT has urged drivers to reduce speed and exercise caution while traveling through the work zone. Appropriate signage, law enforcement details, and messages will be in place to guide motorists through the area. All scheduled work is weather-dependent and subject to change without notice. The development are part of MassDOT's ongoing $337 million Haverhill-Methuen Bridge Replacement Project, which includes replacing the I-495 bridges over the Merrimack River, Route 110/113 and Industrial Avenue. The project is reconstructing multiple aging bridges, originally built in the 1960s, along a 1.5-mile stretch of I-495 through Haverhill and Methuen. They remain safe but are nearing the end of their service life and must be replaced, MassDOT wrote. This work will improve safety, reduce long-term maintenance needs, and enhance traffic operations along one of the region's most heavily traveled corridors. The four-phase project began in the summer of 2025 and is now in phase one. Its next phase is expected to start later this summer and continue through the spring of 2028. During that phase, traffic will be shifted onto a newly constructed southbound bridge while crews demolish the existing northbound bridge, construct a new northbound bridge in its original location, and begin installing noise barriers along the northbound side. The project is expected to be completed in the spring of 2030. For current traffic conditions, travel can download the Mass 511 mobile app or visit math511.com to view live traffic cameras, travel times, real-time traffic conditions, and project updates before heading out. Susan.
In the Sun, a leadership transition. Community Teamworks CEO to step down. Howell leaves in September. Board begins search for new CEO. In Lowell, Community Teamwork, Inc. announced Tuesday CEO Carl Howell will step down from his role effective September 11 to pursue another leadership opportunity. The Community Teamwork Board of Directors has begun a leadership transition process, including the appointment of an interim CEO while a search is conducted for the organization's next CEO. We are grateful to Carl for his leadership, vision, and unwavering commitment to Community Teamwork's mission, said Sheila Oach, president of the Community Teamwork Board of Directors. Under his leadership, Community Teamwork has strengthened its impact throughout the greater Lowell region, expanded critical services, and positioned the organization for continued success. While we are sorry to see him leave, we are excited for him as he embarks on his next chapter of his career. Howell joined CTI in 2010, holding a number of roles at the nonprofit before he became CEO on November 1, 2024, the same day former longtime CEO Karen Frederick retired. Howell informed the board in advance of his departure, allowing the organization to take a thoughtful and deliberate transition that will ensure continuity of leadership and operations. Leaving Community Teamwork is one of the most difficult professional decisions I have ever made, Howell said. This organization has been much more than a workplace. It has been a mission and a community that I have been honored to serve. I am deeply grateful to our board, leadership team, employees, partners, and supporters for their dedication and commitment to improving lives every day. He added, "I leave knowing community teamwork is in an exceptionally strong position. We have an outstanding leadership team, an extraordinary staff, and a dedicated board of directors. I am confident they will continue advancing the mission and delivering the high-quality programs and services our communities depend upon." The board emphasized that Community Teamwork's operations, strategic initiatives, and community partnerships will continue without interruption throughout the transition. Community Teamwork has successfully served our region for more than six decades because of the strength of its people and its mission, Oach said. Our experienced leadership team, together with our dedicated staff across the organization, will continue advancing Community Team's mission and supporting the individuals, families, and communities we serve throughout this transition. As the board appoints interim leadership and conducts a search for the next chief executive officer, we move forward with confidence in the strength, commitment, and collective leadership of the entire Community Teamwork team. Community Teamwork is one of Massachusetts' largest community action agencies, serving tens of thousands of residents each year through programs that promote economic opportunity, housing stability, early education, workforce development, energy assistance, and family well-being throughout Greater Lowell and the surrounding region. Additional information regarding interim leadership and the CEO search process will be shared as it becomes available. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. In Andover, a part of Beacon Street will have a new traffic pattern this summer. The Select Board unanimously voted to approve changes to traffic rules and regulations at the Beacon Street intersection as proposed by Safety Officer Glenn Oda at its Monday meeting. Southbound vehicles on Beacon Street in the left lane must turn left onto Lowell Street with the amended traffic rules. Oda said the intersection was looked at 6 years ago when the town hired Somerville-based engineering firm Design Consultants, Inc., or DCI, to do a traffic study at the intersection of Beacon and Lowell Streets and Shawshene Road. Vehicles using the existing traffic pattern can use the left lane only to make left turns or go straight while the right lane is for right turns only. The recommendation that came out of the traffic study was to flip-flop the traffic pattern so the right lane is the shared right turn and straight lane, and the left lane would then be used only for turning left. The reasoning behind the switch was the queuing on Beacon Street heading southbound. The recommendation was reviewed with the Transportation Working Group and decided to move forward with a new traffic pattern. There is no change to traffic signals or their timing, Oda said. It's very simple, just pavement markings and some new signs, and that's it, he said. Select Board member Alex Vispoli asked how the changes fit into the Route 133 corridor project. Oda said it's the reason has been advanced to alleviate some of the cars building up on Beacon Street as more modifications are coming to the area. It's time to go forward, he said. The proposed Route 133 corridor project will reconstruct part of the roadway spanning 1.25 miles from West Parish to Shawshene Village, improving the intersections at Beacon Street and Shawshene Road and Route 28. Improvements include a shared-use path along part of the roadway to promote pedestrian and bicyclist safety, along with traffic signal upgrades, stormwater drainage upgrades, added designated turning lanes, and accessible curb ramps. The project has received state and federal funding, including a $15.2 million commitment from the Transportation Improvement Program in fiscal 2029. There will be signage to alert travelers on the road of the upcoming traffic pattern change approved by the Select Board. Message boards will be put out on the road about a week prior to the change. Police officers will also be out on Beacon Street to monitor the situation, Oda said. Select Board member Kevin Coffey said that there was the same problem on the opposite side of the street coming from Haverhill Street. He said people want to go straight through the Shaoxing Square intersection and are inevitably caught for a long time behind people trying to make a left turn onto Main Street because they're a right-only lane on the other side. Coffey said the plan is to work on that intersection as part of the 133 corridor project and wanted to know what was different about the Beacon and Lowell Streets and Shaoxing Road intersection. He asked why the town would advance some and not all of the work that will be done as part of the corridor project, as it is possible to do so. There are two different consulting engineers that have handled each intersection. DCI studied the intersection long before the corridor project was developed and found this option is an appropriate solution for this particular intersection, Public Works Deputy Director Arthur Montanose said. The town heard through its consultant for the corridor project, civil engineering firm TEC, that while there is an attraction to create a left turn lane only, it won't improve the functionality of Shaoxing Square. He said it could have the opposite effect on the Shaoxing intersection. Susan.
In the Sun, Haverhill, river tests safe after sewer break, from the Boston Herald. All sites tested along the Merrimack River have begun reporting safe levels of fecal bacteria after the massive sewage break in Haverhill over 2 weeks ago. Beaches across the North Shore fully reopened to swimming over the weekend, and some lawmakers are now seeking funding for long-term fixes. As of Sunday, July 12th, over 10 days after the temporary fix of Haverhill's sewer main break, bacteria levels in the Merrimack River downstream of the repair appear to be back within normal ranges. Data delayed 24-plus hours due to lab incubation time, the Merrimack River Watershed Council reported Tuesday. Seven sites along the Merrimack River began to be tested for fecal bacteria levels following two breaks discovered in Haverhill's sewer main on June 26, which then dumped 7 to 10 million gallons of sewage into the river a day for about 5 days. Haverhill finished installing an initial temporary bypass line to stop the flow on July 1. Sunday's results are the first time all sites along the Merrimack River tested safe, the MRWC said, with West Newbury and the mouth of the river taking the longest to begin to register safe readings. Ocean-facing beaches began to reopen following the halting of the sewage flow weeks prior, and the final beach closure in Newburyport lifted Saturday. All the beaches closed to swimming following the break were reopened as of Tuesday, according to Massachusetts Beach Water Quality Dashboard. Shellfish harvesting areas closed after the sewage break in Newbury, Rowley, Ipswich, Essex, Gloucester, and Rockport were also testing safe and reopened on July 9. The earliest date allowed 1 week after the sewage overflow was halted, though some remained closed after the emergency lifted due to routine rainfall closures. Other shellfish harvesting areas around Salisbury Beach, the Merrimack River, and Plum Island remained closed as officials continued to test the areas for bacteria levels. MRWC said Tuesday that the test results for the sites, which lead from Haverhill to the where the river meets the ocean, are always over 24 hours old due to lab incubation time, and results can change considerably in 24 hours. There were some elevated results in Newburyport Harbor over the weekend, but the nonprofit stated they believe these are more likely a repeat of elevated midsummer readings documented in 2025 and not a lingering impact of the recent Haverhill sewer break. MRWC said a multi-year investigation is scheduled to begin in the fall to examine source of the unexplained bacteria readings from 2025. The city of Haverhill said they are now in the midst of investigating the cause of the break and beginning long-term repairs in their latest update last week. Several congressional representatives also sought federal assistance in addressing Haverhill's sewer issues Tuesday. Reps Seth Moulton and Lori Trahan said they requested additional federal support from U.S. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin to assist the response to the ongoing situation in Haverhill, stating local governments cannot shoulder the costs of long-term infrastructure modernization without stronger, more reliable federal partnership. The representatives also warned the EPA against a 2027 budget proposal to cut federal water infrastructure funding by roughly 90, slashing the Clean Water State Revolving Fund from approximately $2.5 billion to just $155 million. Moulton heralded an amendment he offered to the Water Resources Development Act in the House, raising the ceiling on federal support for the Haverhill sewer system by $10 million to a total of $50 million. Senators Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren and Rep. Lori Trahan also introduced a Water Emergency and Technical Assistance Act to amend the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Federal Water Pollution Control Act on Tuesday, citing the crisis in Haverhill. The bill would authorize technical and financial support in emergency situations like Haverhill's breaks and grants for clean water and drinking water infrastructure. Trahan said unlike the aftermath in Haverhill, the bill puts real federal money on the table the moment an emergency like this hits, so no community has to face it alone. Water system emergencies spell disaster for their communities. They're expensive, bad for business, and dangerous to public health, Markey and Warren said in a statement. Our communities deserve clean water and quick access to support in response to emergency situations that put their health and economies in danger. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. Trump administration orders ICE to suspend most vehicle stops after two deadly shootings. Biddeford, Maine. Trump administration officials have told Immigration and Customs Efficient officers to suspend most vehicle stops after two deadly shootings in a little over a week, according to a person familiar with the matter. The order Tuesday came a day after an ICE officer shot and killed a Colombian man in Maine, renewing criticism of the agency's tactics during enforcement operations. The suspension is not absolute and has room for exceptions when executing a criminal warrant or working with partner agencies, according to a person who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive law enforcement operations. DHS said Monday that an officer, fearing for public safety, shot and killed Duran Guerrero while officers were watching the home of someone they believed was in the U.S. illegally and facing a final order for removal from the country. It said in a post on X that when ICE tried to stop a car driven by somebody who came from the home, the vehicle attempted to flee and the officer fired. That was a shift from how King earlier described the encounter when he said Homeland Security Mark Wayne Mullen told him the officer opened fire after the man tried to use his vehicle as a weapon. King said Mullen told him the officers were trying to serve an arrest warrant, but not for the man who was shot. DHS, which oversees ICE, didn't respond to an email seeking clarity on what led to the shooting. In a scathing post on X, outgoing Colombian President Gustavo Petro called the shooting a targeted killing at the hands of the U.S. government. Petro, who has openly quarreled with U.S. President Donald Trump, urged Trump to provide an explanation and accused ICE officers of treating Duran Guerrero as an inferior being without rights. The shooting also sparked outrage in Maine, where hundreds of protesters gathered Tuesday outside an ICE detention center in Scarborough, just up the coast between Biddeford and Portland. "These people are killers. They must leave our state now," organizer Tred Chretien told the crowd, including some who held signs reading, "Stop the murder and end this terror." Maine's congressional delegation on Tuesday demanded a comprehensive, transparent, and expedited investigation. questions surrounding the shooting. Duran Guerrero's shooting marks at least the ninth time ICE has used deadly force since Trump began his immigration crackdown. Photos show bullet holes in Duran Guerrero's car windshield, but the officers involved in the shooting don't have body cameras, leaving many questions. Among them, how close the officer was to the vehicle when they fired, where the officers told Duran Guerrero to stop, and why ICE believes he had put the public in danger. We are always evaluating our procedures to keep our officers safe and criminals off our streets. We will not disclose or discuss law enforcement tactics, an ICE spokesman said in a statement. Maine's Attorney General's Office, which noted that it is working with federal agencies to investigate, said initial statements suggest the driver was trying to flee and the direction officer, whose name hasn't been released and who has been placed on leave. The state's other senator, Republican Susan Collins, said Mullen told her that DHS's Office of Inspector General is investigating in cooperation with the FBI. Democrats seeking to unseat Collins in November sought Tuesday to connect her with the public's unease over ICE's methods. Collins later said in a statement that all ICE needs to improve, eliminating the agency would make the nation less safe. Video shows the shooting's aftermath. According to the neighbors and public records, Guerrero lived in an apartment about 150 feet, 46 meters, from where his car came to a rest outside an apartment building across the street from a pawn shop and laundromat. Video from nearby business's security camera obtained by the AP shows a white car slowly approaching an intersection before making several circles. A law enforcement SUV blocks its path, and two officers open the driver's door and drag out a limp body. It isn't clear from the video when the shots were fired. Daniel Bocher said he heard a pop, pop, pop and ran to the intersection. His face was bloody. His head was bloody, Bocher said. I clearly heard the victim say, I tried to stop. Bocher said the officer who shot Duran Guerrero walked close to him. He looked at me and said, you tried to run me over or something to that effect, Bocher said. I don't remember his exact words. Duran Guerrero is survived by his wife and young daughter, two advocacy groups, the Maine Immigrants' Rights Coalition and Presente, said Duran Guerrero was authorized to work in the United States. Neighbors say Duran Guerrero was a friendly and familiar face, even though they rarely chatted because he didn't appear to speak English. Sadie Dilboy and Corey Poland, who owns the laundromat near the intersection, said they saw Duran Guerrero all the time. Everybody knows him, said Dilboy, who remembered that he often came to their store with his daughter and gave her quarters to buy candy. Claudia Morton, who often waved to Duran Guerrero, was distraught. The whole world should be crying, she said. Brooke reported from New Orleans, and Sistak from New York, Associated Press reporters Astrid Soares in Bogota, Colombia, and John Seaver in Toledo, Ohio, contributed. Susan.
In the Sun, the five-minute read. Lowell's Sun signs win recognition. The restoration of the Lowell Sun signs was recognized with the Paul and Nikki Tsongas Award by Preservation Massachusetts at their annual awards ceremony at Fenway Park on June 11. The iconic twin neon signs, installed on the roof of the Sun Building in 1934 at the corner of Merrimack and Prescott Streets, were relit last October following a restoration project. The effort to restore and convert the signs to LED began in 2017. Accepting the award from Preservation Massachusetts Executive Director Jessica Rudden-Dube were Lowell Historic Board Chair George Valeris and Restoration Project Manager Stephen Stowell, formerly the city's Historic Board Administrator. To learn more about the project, the history of the Sun Building and its twin roof signs, and the restoration, visit the project's website at lowellsunsign.com. Art Show and Reception in Lowell. The Arts League of Lowell presents its latest show, Considering the Third Dimension, through Sunday, August 30, at 307 Market Street. The installation features a collection of sculptural works by nearly 30 artists, including Goddess of the Air by Georgia Renfro. The Arts League of Lowell fosters and celebrates community art. Gallery hours are Wednesday through Sunday from noon to 4 p.m. For more information, call 978-221-5018. Email info@artsleagueoflowell.org or visit artsleagueoflowell.com. DCR Summer Nights Activities in Lowell. Enjoy family fun evenings at the Pawtucket Farm Wildlife Sanctuary Thursdays, July 16, 23, and 30, and August 6, from 4 to 6 p.m., 1413 Varnum Road. Learn about nature, food, and farming through interactive, themed, and station-based activities during these free summer nights programming sponsored by the Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation. A block party celebration is scheduled for Saturday, August 22. For more information, visit lowelllandtrust.org/summer-nights. Queer Book Club in Lowell. LGBTQ plus Lowell invites the community to a book club to discuss Plastic Prism Void by Violet Allen, Thursday, July 16 at 6 p.m. at Lala Books, 189 Market Street. For a full lineup of book clubs and other events, call 978-221-5966 or visit lalabookstore.com. Lowell Farmers Market in Lowell. The Community Teamwork Farmers Market takes place Fridays through October 9 from 1 to 5 p.m. at 350A Dutton Street in front of the Hamilton Canal Garage in downtown Lowell. A program of the Entrepreneurship Center, Community Teamwork has sponsored the Lowell Farmers Market since 1979, offering fresh, locally grown produce from area farmers, as well as honey, baked goods, prepared meals, handcrafts, and more. Enjoy live entertainment, cooking demonstrations, and activities for the whole family. The market is a U.S. Department of Agricultural authorized farmers market and accepts Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, Women, Infants, and Children and Healthy Incentives Program benefits. For more, save the date, tour, UTEC, in Lowell. The public is invited to join the UTEC team to tour the space, hear about the programs, and meet the team members Wednesday, July 22 at 9 a.m. at 35 Warren Street. The event features coffee and pastries. UTEC helps young people overcome the challenges of poverty, gang involvement, and unemployment. Other Wednesday tours include September 16, October 7, and November 4. For more information, call 978-856-3902 or visit utecinc.org or email Ashley Barabolt Vlicklin at abaribeult-vlcan@utecinc.org. The 5-Minute Read highlights things to do, places to go, and people to know in the greater Lowell area. Have news to share? Send it to news@lowellsun.com. Submissions must be received at least 1 week in advance to be considered for publication. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. Nice to hear their encouraging contributions. Okay. Their view, promising path to a bipartisan fix of Social Security emerges. The need to reform Social Security to keep by far the most important government assistance program solvent has long been obvious. The baby boom from 1946 to 1964 kept the ratio of workers paying Social Security taxes to the number of retirees receiving Social Security benefits at a healthy level for decades. But after birth rates plunged by more than half in the 1970s, the math was plain. Social Security reserves steadily would be depleted when baby boomers started turning 65 in 2011, requiring basic changes to keep the benefits so many rely on from shrinking. It is a sad commentary in the increasing superficiality of American politics that presidents from January 1993 to January 2009, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, treated this as a bigger issue than successors Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden. But the latest and grimmest Social Security trustees report issued last month should change that. Trustees warned that if changes are not made, reserves will be wiped out by late 2032, requiring a 22% cut in benefit for the 70 million plus older Americans forecast to then be receiving monthly checks. Given a long stalemate on this issue, it's easy to assume that this catastrophe will come to pass. Many Republicans and affiliated think tanks still seek partial privatization of Social Security. That means profits for somebody. But even though a key to Trump's political rise in 2016 was his loud disdain for this unpopular approach. Meanwhile, many Democrats and the influential American Association of Retired Persons oppose any changes that go beyond sharply increasing the inflation-adjusted taxable maximum of annual wages, $1,084,500, subject to the hefty 12.4% payroll tax. But the good news is that another hugely influential group, the wealthiest 15% of U.S. households, are surprisingly supportive of a reform in which they would face the biggest new burden. The Reagan National Economic Forum Public Policy Survey, released in May by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, found far more support for means testing, limiting Social Security benefits for the most affluent retirees, than broad tax increases. The survey showed 71% of Americans support this fix, including strong majorities of Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, and 60% of households earning more than $200,000 a year. The most common means testing proposal is setting a formula that steady reduces benefits based on income or wealth thresholds. There would be huge fights over the details, but number crunching by the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget shows the promise of means testing to put Social Security on a far more solid ground going forward, averting or limiting the crisis that looms in 2032. As the survey shows, the most enduring criticism of means testing that Social Security was deliberately designed as a universal program, not a welfare program, to ensure its durability, simply no longer holds. Most Americans are open to the idea of seeing Social Security as earned insurance against poverty and old age, as policy wonk and means test enthusiast Mickey Krause wrote last month. It's time for a bipartisan coalition to act on this fact and head off disaster. Susan.
In the Sun, Congress. House passes bill that would make daylight saving time permanent. In Washington, from the Associated Press, there will be no turning back the clock if the House has its way. The House passed a bill Tuesday that would make daylight saving time permanent. Proponents, including the White House, argued the change would provide more daylight during the times that Americans are most active. The vote was 308 to 117. Daylight saving time is that period between spring and fall when clocks in most parts of the United States are set 1 hour ahead of standard time. States could opt out if their respective legislatures act to do so before the bill's enactment. The Senate would also have to pass the bill before it could be signed into law, but it's unclear if it will do so. Rep. Gus Bilirakis said Americans are ready to ditch the switch. saying that changing the clock twice a year creates unnecessary disruption. More important, he said, it would give families more daylight time in the evening to spend outdoors and support local businesses. In my home state of Florida, where tourism is a cornerstone of our economy, having more predictable daylight hours is a practical improvement that benefits workers, businesses, and visitors alike, Bilirakis said. Detractors said permanent daylight saving time would lead to darker and potentially more hazardous winter mornings where children will be waiting for school buses and parents will be driving to work in darkness. Millions of Americans will wake up during the winter months in complete darkness with the sun not rising until long after people get up and travel to school or work or have to go about their days, said Rep. Mary Gay Scanlon. Rep. Jim McGovern said he supported the bill, but he questioned whether it was the best way for Congress to be spending its time. For folks getting crushed by rent, groceries, utility bills, and health care costs, is this really the best the majority can do? McGovern said. Is this really the most pressing issue before the American people at this moment? A 2025 poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research shows that if forced to choose, most Americans would prefer to keep that extra hour of daylight in the evening. If they had to choose one option for the entire country to use, more than half of adults, 56%, prefer making daylight saving time permanent, with less light in the morning and more light in the evening. About 4 in 10 prefer standard time, with more light in the morning and less in the evening. The White House weighed in before the House vote, calling the Sunshine Protection Act a popular, common-sense reform and saying advisors would recommend the president sign the bill if it reaches his desk. Members of Congress have long been interested in the potential benefits and costs of daylight saving time, since it was first adopted as a wartime measure in 1942. The Senate passed a bill 4 years ago to make daylight saving time permanent, but it stalled in the House. Back to you, Jean-Luc.
Thank you. I think President Nixon, to try to save energy, did this by decree a while, and I remember waiting for the school bus in the dark in the morning, and I didn't like that one bit. Okay, letters to the editor. July is Minority Mental Health Month. Summers are typically busy with vacations, events, celebrations, and other ways to fill a calendar. College students are busy planning to see people they've been apart from for semesters, and high school students are getting a taste of freedom, spending time with their friends before another school year begins. People are constantly making plans to see each other and catch up during the summer, no matter what stage of life they're in. But when we're catching up with others, are we really checking in on how they're actually doing? Addressing mental health and ensuring others know they can talk about whatever they may be going through are crucial first steps in reducing the stigma surrounding mental health. While that stigma has improved with greater recognition and awareness, there is still room for improvement. For instance, in case you were not aware, July is National Minority Mental Health Awareness Month. Mental health is not one size fits all. While some approaches improve the mental health of most people, effectively addressing someone's mental health requires looking at the whole person. For minorities, it's important to account for cultural and social factors. Every community has different views on mental health. Knowing the mental health views someone is accustomed to enables informed support. Often, mental health is viewed as an individual issue, as if each person must fight an inner battle alone. However, that's not true. Talking about mental health with others, encouraging them to share, and being willing to listen and support them when they are doing, when they do among themselves, the easiest ways to get help. Staying silent and not asking hard questions can make someone feel alone, which can be detrimental. For example, youth suicide is often called the silent epidemic because it's not widely discussed or addressed. Talking about what most people want to ignore can improve lives and prevent suicides. Speaking up, being willing to listen, and recognizing when somebody needs help go a long way. The Jason Foundation is a nonprofit organization dedicated to preventing youth suicide by providing educational resources to the public at no cost. To view their training videos, information, and materials, or to find your closest Jason Foundation affiliate office, visit www.jasonfoundation.com. The first part is J-A-S-O-N Foundation.com. Be prepared to recognize when somebody may need to talk and then listen when they do. We're all capable of reducing stigma and helping others with mental health. This is written by Mallory Wire, Division Director of the Jason Foundation, Inc. Susan.
In the Sun, Trump administration ICE to suspend most vehicle stops after shootings from the Associated Press in Biddeford, Maine. Trump administration officials told Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers to suspend most vehicle stops after two deadly shootings within a week. People familiar with the decision said Tuesday. The policy change came after an ICE officer shot and killed a Colombian driver Monday in Maine, and a week after one shot and killed a motorist in Houston, renewing criticism of the agency's enforcement tactics that were widely condemned last winter after the killings of Alex Preddy and Renee Good in Minnesota. In Florida on Tuesday, a third man in roughly a week died during an encounter with immigration officers. This time, a 28-year-old man was killed after he was hit by a tractor trailer while running from immigration and other federal officers, authorities said. The suspension of vehicle stops allows room for exceptions when executing a criminal warrant or working with partner agencies, according to a person who spoke Tuesday on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive law enforcement operations. Matthew Felling, a spokesperson for Maine Senator Angus King, said the senator's office was also told by the Department of Homeland Security that ICE was suspending stops. Hundreds of people in Maine protested Tuesday over the fatal shooting of Johann Sebastian Duran Guerrero, a 26-year-old Colombian national. DHS said Monday that an officer, fearing for public safety, shot and killed Duran Guerrero while officers were watching the home of someone they believed was in the U.S. illegally and facing a final order of removal from the country. It said in a post on X that when ICE tried to stop a car driven by someone who came from the home, the person attempted to flee in the vehicle and the officer fired. That was a shift from how King earlier described the encounter when he said Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen told him the officer opened fire after the man tried to use his vehicle as a weapon. King said Mullen told him the officers were trying to serve an arrest warrant, but not for the man who was shot. DHS, which oversees ICE, didn't respond to an email seeking clarity on what led to the shooting. Thank you for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Visit our website where you can tune in to LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Susan and John Luke. Thank you for listening.